From Madison, Wisconsin, in the United States of global hegemony, it's Didactic Syncast with your host, Eric P.
Y'all ready for this?
It's so powerful. Heart-stopping seconds of anxiety.
Hello, Earthlings, and welcome to the Didactic Syncast, your overview of everything important on the planet Earth.
I'm Eric S. Piotrowski, a writer and educator in Wisconsin, USA. I am known as Duke Scath in the world of video games and Twitter, a.k.a. Skartol in the world of Wikipedia and Reddit. Today is Friday, the 11th of August, 2023. Oh my goodness, I'm doing this on YouTube and trying to record, and I don't know what I'm doing. So this is very low quality, and the sound is crazy. And those of you listening, I'm sorry for the additional chaos, because it's been a long time since I've done this show, but whatever. On this program, I bring you a range of news stories, historical and literary perspectives, and my opinions on topics like current events, war, human rights, economics, education, hip-hop music, and killer robots. So buckle up and let's get started.
A little bit better than dope biz. A brand new kid to show biz. With knowledge I persevere, but for now do me a favor. Let me an ear, and we can find a rhyme to fill in space and drop the bass.
I might get struck. I'm not supposed to put copyrighted material on YouTube. Whatever. I'm not trying to get paid off of this, so it is what it is. Anyway, hi, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. It's been a very long time since I've done this show. I can't even remember the last time I did this show. Let me look it up live and see when the last episode was. March of 2022. It's been over a year, almost a year and a half since I've done this show. I was originally going to send out the entire Nimbus X book as an audiobook on this podcast feed, but then I was like, eh. So anyway, it's been a very long time since I've done this program. Life is hectic. School, things that I'm doing, life is busy. So for whatever reason, this wasn't a priority. And then, so the question then is, well, why today? Why did you suddenly decide to do the show today? Is it because today is the day 50 years ago when DJ Kool Herc first did his block party, when he kind of created hip hop? Or started the modern birth of hip-hop? No, that's a coincidence. It really is just a coincidence. But it is a very cool coincidence. And there's no real specific reason, to be honest. I woke up, I had coffee, I did a crossword and a Sudoku like I do every morning in the summer and on the weekends during the school year. And then I was just, downstairs here, and I was like, what should I do today? And I'm gonna write. I've been working on a couple of books this summer, and I was like, it's been a while since I've done a syncast. Let's see if I can hook it up with YouTube as well, and we'll see. I don't know, maybe somebody would want to watch this live. I don't know why, but it is a thing that people might do, so whatever. So if you're not looking at the video format, that's okay, but those of you who are, you'll be able to see articles, which I will link in the show notes and whatnot. So there's all sorts of things there. My summer 2013, so the previous school year, just real quick, since some of you don't know, my school year was very chaotic. I helped to open a new school in the town where I teach, and for whatever reason, I'm not going to name that town, but whatever. Anyway, the point is, new high school, and it was designed in a very unique way to try to break down the pre-assumptions about what a school is, dude. And so that meant that teachers didn't get teacher desks. We have these podiums that we're supposed to put our laptops on, and we can just teach from wherever and roll the podium around. And what even is a classroom? Well, you know what? When you have 30 kids in a room and it's actually smaller than the rooms in the old high school, that creates some real serious problems. And teachers have a lot of stuff. Certainly, I have a lot of stuff. Maybe some teachers don't have a whole lot of physical stuff because a lot of teachers are into digital stuff and it's all digital. Not everything for me is digital, okay? So I need a place to put my stuff, as George Carlin said. And I didn't have a place to put my stuff. So I complained and whined, and eventually I got a long table, which isn't the same as a desk, but it'll do. And so there are a lot of great things about the school year, some really frustrating things about the school year. That's just one example. But, in general, it went well because I love teaching, and I'm very lucky to be a teacher. But I was also very glad when the school year ended. And, you know, AP is a tough class to teach. This is my second year. This was my second year teaching AP English language and composition. And yeah, so I'm going to do some things differently next year. And I'm trying to figure out exactly what that looks like and map out some changes for the coming year. And then this coming year, I also am going to be teaching Creative Writing 1 again, which I wasn't able to teach last year. And I'm also going to be teaching a new class called Real World Reading, which I'm not really totally sure about, but I'm going to meet with someone next week. And I've been planning stuff out for that. And yeah, other things this summer. I went to Florida. Shout out to my brother and my nephew and my sister-in-law and my mom and her husband Rob and Megan and all the family, Kick and Lan and Lara, Joe, and everybody I saw in Florida. It was great. I had a wonderful trip. Thank you so much for your gracious hospitality and the awesome times we had. And if you know, you know. And if I didn't get to see you, I'm sorry. Maybe I'll see you next time. As I said, I've been working on two books this summer. At the end of the last school year, I had this idea for a book called Don't Read This Book, which is designed to appeal to people who don't like reading, which has been a challenging thing to work on this summer because I don't really know the characters very well yet. And it's a weird format. It's not just a straightforward novel. There's like a meta narrative going on. And part of the project has to do with layout. So it's not going to look like a typical book. In various ways, not a graphic novel really, because I'm not going to draw a lot of stuff for it, but it is going to be sort of zine-like in its design elements, sort of. So that's been an interesting challenge. And then because I got frustrated with that project in August here, I've been working on an expanded version, a book about video games, basically, and my relationship to them. It's going to be called Confessions of a Video Game Addict. Many of you know I wrote a piece once upon a time with that title, but it's been many years since I wrote that. And so I've been expanding it and updating it and adding to it. And I'm looking forward to that. And I hope I can get a lot of that done before the end of the summer, but there's only a few weeks left. So who knows? I've also been reading a lot of graphic novels. This has been the summer of the graphic novels, not intentionally, but yeah, I've been reading some other stuff too, but you know, I've been exploring the libraries near our relatively new home and they have a lot of graphic novels. And so I've read some good ones. My favorite, two of my favorites, and there have been a bunch, but the two that stand out are Kate Beaton's book Ducks, where she writes about and draws about her time working in the oil sands, extraction zones, and she was doing office work, but she obviously interacted a lot with the folks who were actually, you know, doing the drilling and the piping and the gushing and the whatever. And it's kind of heartbreaking because there's a lot of horribleness that goes on there in terms of like sexual harassment and sexual violence even. And so that's very frustrating. And she reflects on what it does to the environment and stuff like that. But it's also this very straightforward story of, you know, I need money. Let's go here and work. Like, that's the way it is. So it's about capitalism. It's about, you know, people, and it's about gender, and it's about a lot of things. So it's very, very highly recommended. And the other book that I read that I really like, I'm actually rereading it right now, is, I could go get it and hold it up, Julia Wirtz's book, Impossible People, because it is a really good, the subtitle is A Totally Average Recovery Story. And it's about her alcoholism and dealing with it and relationships and stuff like that. And I've been reading Julia Wirtz books for a long time. And she's always had these clouds of, you know, cynicism and self-deprecation and, you know, everything that's authentic and heartfelt is rolling your eyes at it. And it's so annoying. And it's always made fun of and ridiculed. And that sort of reflects a lot about the zeitgeist, the world that we live in. And, you know, it's a coping mechanism. And so in this book, she finally sort of is honest about all that stuff and says, okay, I've always been pushing people away because, it's a defense mechanism. And it's a lot of heartfelt connection between people, because one of the things that AA does is it says, you know, we need I want to actually quote it correctly. So if I can find a list of the 12 steps. Yeah, here we go. So this is from Alcoholics Anonymous, And here, I'll even put it on the screen. I've got a website for, yeah, there we go. So the 12 steps from Alcoholics Anonymous say, we've admitted we're powerless over alcohol, yada, yada, yada. And there's some critiques of these steps in the book, but whatever. Anyway, item four is always the one that really intrigues me the most. It says, we have made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. And that part of that is quoted in The Wire when Bubs is trying to get clean. And it's a really important line because that searching and fearless moral inventory is something that a lot of people are too scared to do. Most people, especially a lot of young people, are really terrified of making a searching and fearless moral inventory that is honest, right? It's very hard. One of the reasons it's so hard to have conversations with teenagers is because everything that they experience is lacquered in 20 layers of irony, and everything's just a joke and nothing's serious. And this is part of the problem we see in the online world writ large, especially 4chan and 8chan, is that if you're serious about anything, if you say, here's how I feel, you're going to get attacked and ridiculed. We see this in Rocket League. We see it on Reddit. It doesn't matter where you go online. And because young people live so much of their lives online, it's especially prevalent there for them. So anyway, Julia Wirtz in her book finally sort of comes clean with all that and deals with it. And she works on this searching and fearless moral inventory. And it's really beautiful to see it result in some gorgeous connections with people. And I really like it. And so Julia Wirtz, Impossible People. I'm going to put this up on the thing in case anybody ever looks at this. It's great. It's a really good book, and I strongly recommend you check it out. And there's the Goodreads page for it. It's called Impossible People, a completely average recovery story. And I've just been blown away. In fact, in my Goodreads review, I wrote that my top three all-time favorite memoirs now are Mouse, Persepolis, and Impossible People. And that feels like a bit extreme, I guess, but nevertheless, it feels accurate because, there's stuff going on there. So I recommend you check it out. Okay. We should talk about some current events, but I don't really have the jingles for current events. For some reason, those have been lost. So I guess I'll just talk about current events. I don't know where my sound clips went. So anyway, I used to have one here from Consolidated. Have you heard of East Timor? There's no word on Lebanon. Anyway, so current events. Hawaii has been in the news. And if you don't know what's going on in Hawaii, you should find out about it. So there have been horrible wildfires in Hawaii. There have been stories about people having to run into the ocean in order to get away from the fires. And over 50 people have died, and it's just heartbreaking. And one of the things that makes me especially angry about this natural disaster is that it's been made much more dangerous by climate change, as this headline from The Guardian shows us. It is, we are seeing the effects of climate change in real time, and it is definitely not the type of thing where this wouldn't have happened with climate change, right? Without climate change, this still would have happened, right? It's the case that they've become much more dangerous. They're bigger. They're more deadly. They're more powerful because of the climate crisis, right? So we will never be able to say, oh, you know, this drought is because of climate change. This wildfire is because of climate change. This flooding is because of climate change. It doesn't work like that. But the science is very clear that all this stuff is more horrible and more common and more frequent because of climate change. And we need to be doing dramatic things right now to fight this. Today, we need to stop drilling oil out of the ground. We need to change our entire energy policy around the world, but especially in the United States and Europe and China and India as well. We're really not doing this because especially in the United States, we're not. And I can't really speak to the rest of the world, but in the US, there are so many people, especially people in positions of power, Congress, for instance, who say, it's not that bad. We're not in a crisis. They have this attitude that everything's okay. We just need to do a couple of tweaks here and there. And meanwhile, most people in the United States get it. But there, and I'll be honest, and I don't mean to be oversimplifying anything, because those of you who have heard the show before know that I hate oversimplifying stuff. But the truth is that this is really a matter of one political party in the U.S. refusing to accept reality. This is a matter of the Republican Party just refusing to accept the seriousness of the situation and refusing to back any policy that can fight climate change. So as soon as, you know, George W. Bush got into office, he changed and reversed things that Clinton and Gore had done in the 1990s. And then when Obama got into office, he started to make changes again that did address the climate crisis. And the Democrats always address the climate crisis in a very milquetoast, middle-of-the-road way. They're very centrist in general. That's obvious. But it's something, right? At least it's something. And then, of course, when Trump got into office, he just said, ah, the hell with everything. Let's pull out of the Paris Accords and let's just, you know, pretend like he said over and over, climate change isn't real. It's a hoax, yada, yada, yada. And again, you know, Trump advocates will say, well, he never means what he says. So there's this sense in which he can say whatever he wants and nobody needs to care about what he says. So anyway, but what he does is you know, and what the Republican Party continues to do, and members of Congress, and right now they're beholden to this fringe, the Freedom Caucus, I guess they call themselves, whatever. They are this radical far right group that basically is holding the Republican Party hostage, which means the Republican Party is basically holding the United States government in this state of status quo stasis, and you can't change anything on a significant scale, except where the executive branch can say, okay, I will do this thing by fiat, because I don't need, you know, there's certain things the executive branch can do without getting approval from Congress, because Congress isn't going to approve anything that the president wants to do. So, yeah, it's all very frustrating, because we need massive action now on this climate crisis and we're not getting it, and every day that goes by is a day when we're pumping more carbon dioxide into the air, and it's very frustrating and sad, and you know, it breaks my heart, because we're having, you know, let me give an example here from Wisconsin. Canada recently had this series of wildfires across the country of Canada, and the smoke from those wildfires somehow missed most of Canada, and it blew into the U.S. and a lot of it blew into Wisconsin. So we had like a week where our air quality was just trash, and we got alerts every day that were like, don't go outside if you can help it, vulnerable populations are especially at risk, limit outside work. A guy in Texas died, but that was because of the heat rather than the smoke from the wildfires. But you know, the Duchess was out, you know, gardening and stuff, and she was like, I don't feel real well. And it was like a very minor thing, but it was the thing of like, this is affecting every one of us in various ways, right? Florida is having heat waves and Texas is having heat waves, just extreme heat. And, you know, the Duchess shared something with me recently that said, we'll have to recognize, and it's a very sobering thought, this is probably the coolest summer we'll ever have for the rest of our lives. Think about that. It's 100 degrees Fahrenheit in much of the U.S. this summer. A lot of cities have had these unprecedented high heat levels. And it's scary, because if you don't have air conditioning in a lot of places, you're going to die. And what does that mean for people who are unhoused? And what does it mean for elderly folks? It's not a pretty picture. And it's not like there's nothing we can do about this. But we got to do it now, or things are just going to keep getting worse and worse and worse. So, yeah. That's some happy news to start with. But there is there's another news story that I will mention with regard to the climate crisis, and it has to do with oil prices. So the International Energy Agency, the IEA, said there's a risk of higher oil prices, and there's a demand view, which I don't really know much about, but it's basically like, here's how much we have on deck in terms of oil. So OPEC is cutting supply, I guess, which they always do, opening supply, lowering supply, because they want to get maximum prices and whatever. That OPEC has all sorts of reasons for why they do what they do. But again, like, if you think about oil inventory is drawing 2.2 million barrels per day. That's a lot of oil. And, you know, obviously OPEC and other oil producing places have a vested interest in us not transferring to renewable energy sources and reducing energy usage. It's very important that we understand this cannot just be about renewable energy, okay? Because even solar panels and windmills require the mining of crap out of the earth, and they require us to consume stuff in different ways, right? So electric cars, for instance, and I have one, require a lot of nickel and cobalt and coltan and all these things that have to be mined out of the earth. Well, where do they come from? A lot of them come from Central Africa, and there's people who are basically enslaved mining that crap out of the earth, and they don't have any protective gear. And, you know, there's kids doing the mining, and it's just a big mess. So even renewable green sources of energy have horrible consequences. And it's important that we understand, you know, cell phones are another example of things that have, you know, horrible human costs. Cell phones don't exist without coltan, for instance, and coltan often comes from the Democratic Republic of Congo, and there are resource wars going on about who's going to control the coltan. We could have better monitoring of the human rights of the workers who mine the coltan that goes into our cell phones, right? We could have that. We could have cell phones that aren't drenched. Our cell phones right now, sorry, they're drenched in the blood of the people who mine the coltan, right? We could have better lives for those people who mine the coltan, but we'd have to pay more for cell phones. That's how it works, right? Verizon might not be able to say, get a free phone every 3 days, if we had better monitoring of the human rights of the workers who mine the coltan to get us our phones, right? But a lot of people don't want to pay more for their cell phones. So we have this, you know, it's a balance beam. And the more you put things like human rights and workers' rights and preserving the environment on one side of the scale, the other side of the cost is going to go up. And, you know, look, I love cheap consumer electronics as much as anybody, but I would gladly pay more. And everybody who plays video games and uses cell phones and laptop computers and all the rest of it, we should all be willing to pay more in order to make sure that the people who mine the coltan, and if any, I've never worked in a coal mine or a coltan mine or any kind of mine. I don't think I'd last long in one of those places. It's very hard work. And the least we could do is show respect to the people who mine those chemicals, the people who work on these oil fields. We should pay them a living wage. We should demand their health and safety, time off, you know, all that stuff. But those cost money, and we can provide them through taxes, which is why this orthodoxy, especially among Republicans, of lower taxes, lower taxes, lower taxes, that has real human cost around the world, right? And at home. But we can also show our willingness to support human rights and workers' rights by paying more for these devices and not getting new phones every time some new thing comes out. This obsession we have in the United States for the latest gadget, the newest thing, I've got to have this, I've got to have that. Well, where do the materials for those things come from, and how much of what you pay goes toward those materials, and how much more would you have to pay if the actual costs of the production of the thing were represented in the price you pay? Because right now they're not. It's called externalities. I'm getting into economics, but this is the way it works. And the point is that, I cut off on a tangent here, higher oil prices means that we'll have a little less oil. The problem, one of the problems with a news story like this is that higher oil prices mean less income for instance, people who drive trucks for a living, right? If you drive a truck hauling stuff for, you know, Amazon or whatever it is, you pay for your own gas, and the company that hires you, if Amazon hires you to ship, you know, a truck full of stuff from Florida to Wisconsin, they're paying you a certain rate, and they're not paying you for gas. So when your gas prices go up, that eats into your income, right? So truckers are going to be hurt by this. Uber drivers and taxi drivers are going to be hurt by this. A lot of people who, you know, everything that we use has oil factored into it. And a lot of times the workers have to eat those costs. And that's one of the biggest problems with a story like this. But the good news is that it might mean that some people use less oil. And that's what we really need to be doing, is using less oil. And we tend not to do that very often. All right. This was a news story from the Financial Times, moving on now, that I did not think I would be able to read, because the Financial Times has often, here we go, subscribe to unlock this article. I just read it, and now it's blocking me out. Damn you, Financial Times. Well, the Financial Times is not stupid. They know how to make money. So let's see how much I can remember about this news article rather than on the air trying to find another source for this article. And by the way, no one is watching on YouTube, and I don't blame them, because who would want to watch an idiot yammer on about oil and coltan? No one. That's who. I don't know why you're listening, but I'm glad you are. All right, so the news story from the Financial Times. The headline is, which they allow me to read for free, U.S. places $1.2 billion climate bet on tech pulling carbon from the air. Okay, I'm going to have to try to find another source for that for the show notes. But anyway, the story is this. There's this technology that could potentially pull carbon out of the air. Carbon dioxide is the very bad stuff that's causing the climate crisis to spiral out of control. Now, it's very interesting that we're choosing to so basically the Biden administration is adding $1.2 billion in funding to research this technology in order to see if it could, you know, reduce it, to pull out the carbon dioxide from the air, which is pretty cool. I hope that works. I hope it's successful, because that would mean, you know, again, less severe storms, you know, maybe hopefully slowing or even maybe somehow stopping or reversing this climate crisis. And by the way, let me just side note. When I say slowing or reversing this climate crisis, I recognize that that's very unlikely. I know that scientists say that we are causing irreversible damage to the ecosphere and, you know, corals and oceans are in great danger. And it's very unlikely that we're going to be able to stop this thing or reverse it. But it's not impossible. I remember in the 1980s when the hole in the ozone layer was starting to appear, and people were freaking out because we had never really done this sort of thing to the Earth before. We were seeing real evidence of human industrial impact on our Earth with this hole in the atmosphere that was causing UV rays to pass through the atmosphere in a way they had never passed through before. And that was a serious problem, and people were freaking out. And I remember freaking out about that. Well, we saw the threat. Everybody agreed it was a problem, Democrats and Republicans. This was before Republicans had weaponized everything, from M&Ms to Bud Light to movies to, you know, everything's a war zone now for the Republican Party. But back in the 80s, everyone said, oh, this hole in the ozone layer is not okay. What's causing it? Okay, it turns out they were caused by chlorofluorocarbons, CFCs, that were in our spray bottles and deodorants and, you know, whatever. And we banned them. And I don't know the scientific details, but as I understand it, the hole in the ozone layer, because we stopped pumping this crap into it, the Earth managed to kind of close that hole on its own. And because we stopped doing the horrible thing, the Earth kind of recuperated, right? Now, again, I'm not going to tell you that that's a scientific fact and this is what happened for sure, but that's how I remember it, and maybe I'm wrong, but that's how I seem to understand what happened with a hole in the ozone layer. And it's evidence that, and then there were people who were saying at the time, like, this is forever now and we've screwed up and yeah. All I mean to say is that the doomsayers, the people who predict that, you know, we can never fix a thing, they're never called to account for their predictions, right? Nobody is ever called to account for their predictions, right? Nobody is ever pulled back in front of the same media that they first appeared on and said, hey, you said this was going to happen and it didn't. Explain yourself, or you're going to face a consequence for that. Nobody faces consequences. So you can say whatever crazy prediction you want, and if it doesn't come true, whatever, move on to something else, make another crazy prediction. Because the crazy prediction is what gets you eyeballs. That's why very few people are probably watching this show. But if I were to say, you know, Robert Kennedy Jr. is going to win the presidential election, I would get a lot of attention, because that will get clicks. So there's a lot of reasons why people don't listen or watch this show, but whatever. Nevertheless. So anyway, back to this story. The Biden administration is going to put money into pulling carbon out of the air, and that's great. But again, notice that I was going to take a drink of water, but now I'm back on my my point. Anything to avoid reducing energy use, right? It wouldn't take $1.2 billion to get Americans to consume less energy. You know, it would take some money for a public awareness campaign or, you know, making decisions across the federal government, which would then trickle down to a lot of private businesses of we're going to cut energy in this way and that way. We need to dramatically cut energy. So, for instance, if some idiot has two monitors on his computer setup, does he really need two monitors? Maybe he could make do with one. Okay, I'm guilty of that. I should be using one monitor instead of two. But in terms of like industry, that's a pretty low bar. And I would say that, you know, all the plastic crap that gets sold at dollar stores and, you know, I don't know what it is in the UK, HMV or whatever, like all these stores that are everywhere, all these online outlets, all the garbage coming over from China, the plastic shite with Barney the Dinosaur on, I guess it's not Barney anymore, but you know, SpongeBob crap and Simpsons apparel and just all the stuff that we use once and then we throw it away, right? Plastic cutlery, yeah? All these paper napkins and the styrofoam takeout containers. Like all of this stuff that we're constantly consuming. We just got to stop consuming some of it. If we cut the consumption of, you know, styrofoam containers in half tomorrow, that would make a difference. So how about this? Look, do what the Duchess and I do, right? When you go out to eat, if you expect you probably will have some leftovers to take home. They say takeaway in the UK. I was going to say that. Bring your own containers. Bring a reusable container. That's an example of something small you could do today. Bring a reusable container with you if you go to a restaurant where you think you might have leftovers. Because then it's a little less garbage in the world. Now, that's an individual response, and that's not going to be enough to save our planet. But it's an example of, you know, one thing individuals can do. And then if we build on that and continue to grow it, there's other stuff we could do as well to have that kind of impact. Excuse me. Okay. So, that is that. What is next? Okay. So the 2024 U.S. presidential election, I'm not going to say too much about it right now, but I will say this. It is bonkers that Donald Trump is able to run for president of the United States after having tried to overthrow American democracy in January of 2021. That's just unbelievable to me. In fact, Brazil, Bolsonaro, unable to run. I'm going to find an article about this. There we go. Right. AP News. Thank you, AP News. Here we go. So AP News reports that Jair Bolsonaro, who basically... Stop it! All these pop-ups. Bolsonaro in Brazil tried to basically do the same thing that Trump did in the United States. Tried to overthrow the democratic process. And as a result, he was banned from running for office until 2030. Now, maybe they should ban him for life. I would be okay with that. But why is it they can do this in Brazil and we can't do it in the United States? How did it happen in Brazil? A panel of judges concluded that he abused his power and cast unfounded doubts on the country's electronic voting system. The decision upends the 68-year-old's political future and likely erases any chance for him to regain power. Is Brazil that much better than the United States? Could we not do that here? Yes, we could. And I am mad that we're not doing it because I think that any sane observer of the American democratic process will say, yeah, Donald Trump abused his power and he should not be eligible to run for anything. So, it's frustrating to me that we're not able to do that in the United States, but they did it in Brazil. And good for you, Brazil. And I'm going to say Bolsonaro. Sorry, not able to run. Okay, I'm adding show notes on the fly. All right, so it's probably going to be Biden versus Trump again. And the good news is that Trump has had very bad luck getting himself or his people elected. And so, you know, he lost in 2020. His endorsed candidates lost overwhelmingly in 2022 in the midterms. And that does not bode well for his ability to win in 2024. But I keep seeing reports about how his base is more devoted than ever. And he's doing all this fundraising. As many people listening to this show may also know, he's been indicted multiple times for his document fiasco in Mar-a-Lago, and he was convicted in a civil court of sexual assault in New York, I think it was. There may be charges pending in the 2020, January 6th, you know, 2021 attempted coup. And so, you know, those legal consequences may cause problems for him as the election gets closer and closer, but I'll believe it when I see it, right? He's been accused of all sorts of things. He's been impeached twice, the only president in the history of the United States to be impeached twice. Unfortunately, the Congress did not vote to remove him either time. And for the record, the reason that he didn't get removed from office when Nixon did get removed from office, that's an important question, right? This is a parallel series of incidents. Why did Nixon get removed from office when Trump did not? The reason is because in the case of Nixon, a lot of Republican voters saw what Nixon was doing and they hated it. And they said to their senators, their Republican senators, if you don't get rid of this guy, you're next. We're going to get rid of you. And so the Republican senator said, oh, in order for us to stay in power, Nixon has to go. So what did future Republican strategists take away from that experience? They took away, we have to make sure our voters never get too mad for about us. In the future, we have to get them to be like bloodthirsty in their loyalty to us. And that's what they did through a series of incredibly effective propaganda strategies. The Republican leadership has gotten a base that does not seem to care about anything that its leaders do because they're so convinced that the threat of immigrants and drugs and terrorism and trans kids is so great that will allow you to be a sexual predator, will allow you to, you know, do whatever you want. As long as you get us justices on the Supreme Court, you cut our taxes, and you talk about the culture war issues that we care about, that you told us to care about. That's the way the Republican base is operating right now. And that makes me very sad because I talked to Greg DeLacy on this program. I have many friends. Well, I have some friends who are Republicans. And I respect people who believe in limited government. I respect people who believe in so-called traditional family values. I don't agree with them on small government and limited, you know, small government sort of, maybe. Okay. Lower taxes, no, and I've already explained why. Traditional family values often had to do with patriarchy and, you know, oppression of women and silencing and closeting of gays and lesbians and transgender folks. So those are things I have a problem with. But, you know, look, stable, safe families, families that are supported, you know, that's important. We can all agree on that, right? So if those are important benchmarks of your political ideology, I don't have a problem with you on that thing, right? I believe you have your community in mind when you go into the political realm. And that's a good thing. What makes me sad is that you allow that to blind you to the horrible things that Republican leaders are doing right now, including ignoring this climate crisis, which is endangering the health of every person on the planet, and getting sidetracked from the issues that ought to matter, and allowing yourself basically to be led around by the nose to vote for a con man who doesn't care about you at all. Just because he says he cares about you, you go, okay, well, I'll vote for him and I'll fanatically vote for him. I will donate. Think of all the people who are donating money to Trump's legal defense teams. Because he's presenting it as I'm a victim of the woke left, or, you know, the mainstream media is coming after me. Everybody online, I play Rocket League. If they have a Trump thing or a MAGA thing in their, you know, username, I'll make a comment like, why would you support that con man? And he goes, con man. They would just say, oh, you've been corrupted by the media. You've been brainwashed by the media. No, I've looked into who Donald Trump is. And as my friend Soph said, when someone tells you that, she was quoting Maya Angelou, when someone shows you who they are the first time, believe them. And people don't do that with Donald Trump. That we, it's clear who he is. And if you still support him now, you are supporting someone who does not believe in democracy. And that's sick. Last thing I'll say about this, and then I'll move on. I was watching, again, the documentary about Mr. Rogers, Won't You Be My Neighbor? It's a beautiful film. He was such a beautiful man. I love him so much. It mentions at one point in that film, one of the people who knew him, maybe his son, he was a lifelong Republican. And I can't stop wondering what Mr. Rogers would say about Donald Trump, the Republican Party in 2023, and the Republican base in 2023. Because it seems to me, you know, his whole thing was always like, we have to communicate to children that they are loved and that they are perfectly fine the way they are. And I think that's a message. He tried to send that message to adults as well. He did some adult programs, which I have never seen. Old Friends, New Friends, apparently, was the name of the show. It didn't work out very well, apparently. But I'm curious. I'd like to see some of those programs. But, you know, he was all about people needing love and security and truth. And it just, I think it would break his heart for him to look at the Republican Party in 2023 and see how far this organization had come based on what drew him to it once upon a time. And political parties change all the time. We know that the Democrats and Republicans used to be sort of representative of reverse ideologies. Once upon a time, Republicans were the ones who were sort of pushing for racial equality and improved status for African Americans and whatnot. And the Democrats were the ones who were trying to enforce segregation and white supremacy and whatnot. So that's a thing that happens to all political parties. But I think that the Republican Party in 2023 has gotten especially cult-like and especially irrational and especially willing to abide violence and allow hate to flourish inside its tent. And that's sick. And everybody who is a Republican ought to be speaking out against that. Kudos to Liz Cheney for being willing to take on the hatred and the ignorance and the white supremacy and the attack on democracy. And she paid a heavy cost for that, but it's so beautiful to see individuals who are willing to stand up and say no. And kudos to all the Democrats who do the same thing, because they can pay a cost as well. All right, let's move on. What's next? There was a coup in Niger, and I don't really know too much about this, but I'm going to talk about it anyway because I'm an American, and that's what we do. Uh-oh, I'm not muted on the YouTube screen. Anyway, so there was a coup in Niger on the 26th of July. The country's presidential, this is from Wikipedia, the country's presidential guard detained President Mohamed Bazoum and presidential guard commander General Abdurrahmane Chiani. I may be saying that wrong. That's my best guess. Chiani proclaimed himself the leader of a new military junta. And the world has been kind of debating how to respond to this. There is a group of West African nations called ECOWAS, which stands for Economic Community of West African States. And they have said they're planning on doing some military intervention. The United States, Great Britain, and France, I believe, have all shown support for that plan. But then other nations in the region have said, no, we don't need more military intervention here, especially not from the former colonial powers in Europe. Right? Which, you know, leaving aside all the ideological perspectives and all the orthodoxies of what you ought to believe if you are a proponent of anti-colonialism or whatever, I'm somebody who wants to see democracy happen. I'm somebody who wants to see human rights respected, which generally are not respected under military dictatorships. I'm somebody who wants to see, you know, the right to life preserved for ordinary people and journalists and whatever. So I don't really don't know what I think, to be honest. I don't know that I trust the U.S. and the U.K. and France to intervene in Africa for altruistic reasons. But I also don't like the idea of a coup d'etat happening in Niger, just like I didn't like it happening in Egypt when it happened in the early 2000s. I don't remember exactly when that was, but I could look it up. And interestingly, what happened in Egypt is also what's happening with Niger in terms of what the U.S. calls it, right? So the United States government, I believe, has not called this coup in Niger a coup, because as soon as the government says this was a coup, we are required by law to stop sending aid to that country. It may be certain types of aid, it may be military aid, but you know, there's an automatic shift in policy that has to happen. So as a result, the Biden administration, and it certainly would have happened with the Trump administration, I think it happened with either the Obama administration or the George W. Bush administration when Egypt happened, they come up with some other explanation. They say there's been a change of government or whatever. Everyone knows it's a coup, but you can't say the emperor has no clothes. That's forbidden, because then we can't send, you know, aid. And it's a very strange process, because it means that the thing that we know is happening, there was a coup d'etat. That's what everyone calls it, right? That's clearly what happened. Someone in the military took over. That's a coup, right? What else could you call it? Nothing. That's what it is. But you can't call it that. So people are, it's a kind of gaslighting, really. It's like on Futurama when Donkey Kong comes and tries to take over Earth, and Fry goes, "I know that monkey. His name is Donkey." And the professor goes, "Monkeys aren't donkeys. Stop messing with my head." That's kind of how I feel here. So it's a very strange situation, and I hope there's some kind of resolution. Of course, the larger picture is, you know, why are democracies so unstable in Africa and elsewhere? I mean, let's be honest, right? This isn't wildly different from what Trump tried to do in the United States. Fortunately, I believe our institutions were a little more durable, and the civilian rule and the transfer of power is more established in the United States. And that's part of why Trump was unsuccessful. There's a lot of reasons why Trump was unsuccessful, but I don't want anyone to ever think that this is just something that happens over there, right? Because it happens everywhere. It has the potential to happen everywhere. I believe that Africa needs, you know, both South America and Africa, in my opinion, need some kind of Marshall Plan, right? After World War II, the victorious parties, the wealthier parties in the world, said, oh, look, Germany and Japan are in, I think it was just Germany and other parts of Europe, they've been devastated by this war. We should make an investment in rebuilding these places so that they can become productive parts of the world system again. And it worked. But after the devastating wars in Central and South America in the 1980s and 90s, after centuries of colonialism and imperialism and bloodshed and slavery and murder and genocide in Africa, we've never said, well, let's rebuild those places so they can become productive, you know, economically viable members of the world community again. We've never said that. We've never done that. And we should, because that's ultimately, I think, what makes a place sustainable. There's a lot of factors involved here. I don't want to oversimplify it, but that's my take on it. Then there's Operation Lone Star. And I know we've spent a lot of time on these current events things. I'm going to try to wrap this up here. But Operation Lone Star is the name of the Texas strategy to get people to stop coming to the United States without the proper documentation. So according to Wikipedia, it is a joint operation between the Texas Department of Public Safety and the Texas Military Department along the southern border between Texas and Mexico. According to the governor, Greg Abbott, the operation is intended to counter illegal immigration, the illegal drug trade, and human smuggling. It's spending a certain amount of money, yada, 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 yada. Second paragraph of the Wikipedia lead. OLS has drawn criticism from the federal government, state officials, and migrant advocates for its treatment of migrants, including the withholding of water and orders to push migrants back into the Rio Grande. Migrants have also been forced to cross unsafe areas of the Rio Grande due to razor wire set up by OLS, which has led to injuries and caused migrants to become stuck in the wire. Texas Air National Guard members deployed in support of OLS have also criticized the operation's planning and execution, with nearly 30% of 250 participants in a 2022 Air National Guard survey reporting frustration with the operation's length, haste, and involuntary nature. A couple of things I want to make clear here. One is that a lot of the people who are coming into the United States without the proper documentation are applying for asylum. And I want everyone to understand that Article 14 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights says, let me pull it up right here. One, everyone has the right to seek and to enjoy in other countries asylum from persecution. Two, this right may not be invoked in the case of prosecutions genuinely arising from non-political crimes or from acts contrary to the purposes and principles of the United Nations. So if somebody's coming to the United States to seek asylum from persecution, that is a human right. That is not illegal. They have the right to apply for asylum, right? And I had a discussion with someone on Reddit about this recently, and he said, well, is that why there's so much human trafficking and drug trafficking, people pretending to apply for asylum? Maybe. I don't know how high that prevalence is, what that rate is. It might be that that's 50% of people applying for asylum. It might be that it's 0.01% of people applying for asylum. I don't know. But we have a system of, you know, institutions that sort through asylum applications. And I don't know much about that system, but I do know that the Trump administration slashed the funding for those processing centers to the bone. And they intentionally tried to split up families in order to deter people from trying to come across the border, which is a violation of their human right to apply for asylum. Furthermore, rescue.org is an organization that provides assistance to, migrants and people seeking human rights. And they have a website, which I will link in the show notes, that headline is it legal to cross the U.S. border to seek asylum? Family, and this is what they say, the rescue.org. Families escaping violence and persecution in Latin American countries such as Honduras, Haiti, Cuba, Nicaragua, and other countries in crisis have undertaken a dangerous journey to seek safety in the United States. People arriving at the U.S. border have the right to request asylum without being criminalized, turned back, used for political stunts, or separated from the children. Here's how the process works. And they go into a lot of detail about it. So there's this hysteria about drugs and human trafficking. And those are serious problems. I don't mean to indicate that they're not. But, you know, my kid got threatened with death if he didn't join a gang. It's also a serious problem. And the question is, you know, are you going to let this possible abstract notion of drugs coming into your neighborhood outweigh the actual tactile desperation of these families fleeing these horribly violent, desperate situations in Nicaragua or wherever they're coming from, right? And it just breaks my heart to see people demonizing all the people at the U.S.-Mexico border as if they're all, again, going back to what Trump said, as if they're all rapists and murderers and or even a very large percentage of them have those kind of ill intents. And we have so much opportunity, so much beauty, so many resources, so much wealth in this country, and we're so unwilling to share it. It really breaks my heart. So, boo Operation Lone Star and boo Greg Abbott, and make some changes, man. Come on, let's be more compassionate toward each other. All right, let's talk about some economic things. Once again, I do not have my sound clips ready to go, so I will mimic them. Respect, buddy. Here go the tech notch. Bam! Move from the gate now. Cash rules everything around me. Cream, get the money. Dollar bill, y'all. I'll try to get the sound clips back for next time. Beer in the UK. Now I got your attention. Haha. Our first economic story this episode has to do with taxes on alcohol in the UK. So this is from National Public Radio in the U.S. A beer in Britain's pubs just got cheaper thanks to changes in the alcohol tax. It's been a dreary summer in the U.K., which has seen some of the rainiest summer months on record, all while the country continues to deal with the highest inflation in Western Europe. Almost everything from food to fuel to rent is getting more expensive. One thing has just got a little bit cheaper, though. The UK government announced last week that, when did this story come out? This came out today, August 11th. Okay. So last week, the UK government announced what it called the biggest shakeup of alcohol tax in a century. Alcoholic beverages will now be taxed simply based on their strength. That means drinks having an alcohol by volume, ABV, levels below 3.5% will be taxed at a lower rate than drinks with an ABV over 8.5%. Before this change, there were different tax rules for different types of alcohol. In addition to the new changes, the government has also expanded its draft relief scheme, which freezes or cuts the alcohol duty on drinks poured on tap. This means that the duty pubs pay on each draft pint will be cheaper than in supermarkets. So a pint could be up to 11 pence cheaper if the pubs pass the savings on to customers, which they may or may not do. Yeah, thank you, JLV. Finally, some good news. Amen. You will have cheaper beer, and it's all thanks to Prime Minister Rishi Sunak. I don't know if it's actually his doing, but they call this the Brexit Pubs Guarantee, an acknowledgement of the difficulties that pubs are facing. The Finance Minister, Jeremy Hunt, announced the changes with a visit to a local, quote, "Pubs have been facing a lot of competition from supermarkets, and we want to make sure they remain competitive," he said in a video. He promised that the duty for a pint in the pub will always be less than duty in a supermarket. Britain has always set its own alcohol taxes, so this movie is less likely about Brexit and more likely about a general election next year, some analysts say. Also, as skeptics pointed out on social media, beer already costs less in a number of European Union countries than in the UK. So it may be that if there had been no Brexit, beer would actually be even less than it will be under these new rules. But nevertheless, I thought it would be pretty interesting to talk about that beer tax change law thing. And equally interesting is X, right? Not ecstasy. That is interesting. But I'm talking about what the service previously known as Twitter. The CEO of X, and I'm sure you all know that Elon Musk changed the name of Twitter to X, which is one of the dumbest rebrandings of all time. There's a really cool economics professor, last name Galloway, and he said this is going to go down as one of the worst rebranding episodes ever. And yeah, he changed the name from Twitter to X. Twitter, as many people have pointed out, had one of the highest brand recognitions in the world. Everybody knew what Twitter was. Everybody recognized that little bird. They had such an iconic logo. It was something that everybody knew. And for the sake of his ego and this vision he has of this other thing he could turn Twitter into, in addition to firing half the staff or three quarters of the staff at Twitter, in addition to allowing, you know, pedophiles and white supremacists back onto Twitter, in addition to bungling the whole verified process and a lot of other stupid moves that Elon Musk made, he changed the name from Twitter to X. The logo is stupid and everybody hates it. But the CEO of X says that brands are coming back. This is from Axios.com. In her first television interview since taking over as CEO of X, formerly known as Twitter, Linda Yaccarino said advertisers are returning to the platform and that in terms of profitability, quote, "we're pretty close to break even." Now, that's all I'm going to read from her comments. I don't buy this for a second, to be honest. I know that the process of creating brand identity has a lot to do with what people think your brand identity is. In other words, nothing succeeds like the appearance of success. So one of the things that CEOs need to do at all times is deny the horrible reality of their company's economic situation, right? It's the same thing we were just talking about with the coup, right? If your company is hemorrhaging money and everything's crashing and burning around you, the number one thing you don't want to say is our company is hemorrhaging money and everything is crashing and burning. What you want to say is we're going through a period of readjustment and we're getting back to a good status and we're more lean and efficient and we have profit projections of such and such or whatever. We saw this with Theranos. We saw this with WeWork. We saw this with Enron. We saw this with WorldCom. I could keep going, but I'm not going to. Don't ever trust anything that a CEO says. Right? The number one thing they do is change your perception of reality. And that's what X and Facebook and Instagram and Threads and all the other companies are trying to do anyway, is change the way you see reality so that it's not what it really is. But nevertheless, I thought it was very amusing. And I never want to any mention of Elon Musk to come and go without reminding people that Elon Musk has been a rabid anti-union boss. Tesla is the only American car manufacturer that does not have union representation. And that's just mind blowing. It's the fact that they can get away with making these cars and be the only company that makes cars in the United States without union representation is a travesty. And we know that Amazon has busted unions. We know that Starbucks has busted unions. A lot of these big companies destroy people who try to create unions. And again, creating a union, joining a union, is a fundamental human right. It is a right in the United States under the National Labor Relations Board Act. It is a right under the Universal Declaration of Human Rights to join a union. So the fact that Tesla employees cannot join unions, and presumably ex-employees cannot join unions, the fact that most Amazon employees cannot join a union, is a violation of their human rights. So I don't like Elon Musk for that reason and for many other reasons as well. Boo Elon Musk. All right, moving on. Let's talk a little bit about education. We don't need no education. Florida. Hello, Florida. So Ron DeSantis is the governor of Florida, and he is a person that I don't like very much. He's done a lot of stuff to make education in Florida worse. And one of the things he did was, I don't think he outlawed the teaching of AP African American history. Advanced placement is this sort of elevated curriculum that allows students to take basically college level courses in high school. And so they're more accessible. If you pass the AP exam with a 3 out of 5 or higher, a lot of colleges will give you credit for that class. It's a big deal. AP curriculum is a very big deal. And the AP curriculum is administered by the College Board. That's the company that administers the AP curriculum. So there was this kerfuffle. I don't remember the details. Maybe it'll say in this article. But basically, Ron DeSantis had said that Florida schools will not offer AP African-American history because, in his words, it was too woke. Right? He has this whole stop woke ideology, and anything that is deemed to be woke, including Disney World, is attacked and derided and, you know, assaulted. So AP psychology was on the woke chopping block at a certain point, but apparently now AP psychology is allowed. So let's see what The Hill says. Florida Education Commissioner Manny Diaz Jr. sent a letter to superintendents Wednesday making it clear AP psychology can be offered in its entirety in K-12 public schools. Over the past week, Florida school districts have been switching their course offerings from AP psychology after the College Board indicated it would not accept the class as taught in Florida due to the state's new law that bans discussion of sexual orientation and gender identity in most classroom settings. Diaz told schools last week they could offer the class, but it was not clear if educators would be allowed to teach the lessons regarding sexual orientation and gender identity, which the College Board said would need to be in the curriculum for the class to count for college credit. On Wednesday, Diaz sent another letter to make it clear that no part of the AP psychology class violates Florida law. Quote, as Commissioner of Education, I tasked my team with reviewing the AP psychology framework at length. I believe it was clear in my previous letter, but I want to make sure there's no room for misinterpretation, Diaz said. Look, again, this is an example of ideology overpowering reality, basically, right? Because AP psychology, and look, the College Board is the most apolitical organization that has ever lived. They are always about just like, status quo, here's the world as we know it. But they are composed, some of the people who work at the College Board are educators, and they want to include a global perspective and an understanding that, you know, for instance, literature, an AP class I have taught, is not just about writers from the United States and the UK and Europe who are white guys, right? There are important women authors, there are important writers from every continent, every country around the world that ought to be embraced when we talk about literature, right? So the standard canon of just Shakespeare and Steinbeck and Melville and Poe and, you know, whatever, that's not the way to think about the literary canon. And so, yes, they're broadening their perspectives, but it's not any kind of program to, like, you know, make people think a certain way. It's just like, here's what the world of psychology thinks. Here's what the DSM-5 or 6 or whatever number they're on right now. Here's what it says about gender identity and sexual orientation. So the fact that Ron DeSantis is angry about that, the fact that he wanted to change the AP or ban AP African-American history, is just him being at war with the way that the world sees these curricular choices. It's really sad. It's, again, weaponizing everything, trying to make everything into a war where they're coming for your kids, right? It used to be drugs. They're coming for your kids with drugs. So we have to make athletes pee in a jar to drug test them to make sure they're not doing drugs. Now it's, well, you know, trans kids want to be in women's sports. So we have to have medical examination of kids' genitals to make sure that they're actually girls or whatever. It's so horrifying. It's so disgusting. So, yeah, anyway, that's a thing that's happening. And it's personal for me. This thing with Ron DeSantis is personal for me, not just because I come from Florida, but because I went to a place called New College. And New College, for those who don't know, is a beautiful school. It certainly has been a beautiful school. It was established in the 60s as this alternative learning space. And I went there in the 1990s, and it was magnificent. It was perfect for me. It was everything I wanted from the college experience, and a lot of things I didn't want from the college experience. But mostly it was beautiful. It gave me freedom to explore whatever I wanted to explore. I had awesome professors who opened me up to so much important stuff. It helped me learn how to think. It helped me learn how to learn in a way that was not based around grades. But because New College is small, and because Ron DeSantis realized he had the power to change New College, he attacked it. And he's been attacking it throughout 2023. And he's basically trying to destroy it. And the students there and the Alumni Association and all the people who love what New College has always been have been fighting valiantly to defend the best parts of New College. But a lot of the professors have left. The changes that have been made, Ron DeSantis was able to just appoint an entirely new board of directors, and they've made all these changes, and it's basically destroying New College. I have students who thought about going there. I have friends who thought about going there, and then they said, no, I'm not going there now. So, this New Yorker goes into all the details about what DeSantis is doing or was in February of 2023. A lot of it has come to pass. Some of it hasn't. And it remains to be seen if New College can withstand this assault. It may be the case that the next governor will switch things around again and allow New College to do what it has been doing. Or it may be that DeSantis is causing irreparable harm to New College. It's not clear. But again, it makes me really sad that, and look, New College has like 800 students. It's tiny. It has very little impact on the surrounding community. Most people, it's in Sarasota, Florida. Most people in Sarasota, Florida know nothing about New College. Right? It's not sending out indoctrinated zombies to churn Florida into some wasteland of LGBTQ identity and radical feminists. That doesn't happen, right? It's a tiny school where a lot of young people have gone to learn how to learn and get the academic freedom that allows them to become awesome teachers and other, you know, awesome members of society. And it just breaks my heart that DeSantis said, I'm going to make this into the battle that will get me political points. And it has earned him credibility. This is something he can point to as a success. In the same way that Scott Walker in Wisconsin pointed to the Act 10 abolition of, in all but name, of public school unions and said, we won. That's a victory. I took on the unions and won. What did you win? You won some lower taxes. That's it. And what was the harm that was caused? Incredible harm. It, still to this day, our classrooms are hurt because of what Scott Walker did. And it's really sad to see the voters of Florida, my home state, rallying behind this guy by the millions and saying, yes, he's the one fighting for us. He's not fighting for you. This doesn't make your life better at all. But you allow yourself to be hoodwinked and bamboozled by a slick-talking schmuck who, apparently, this is true, you can look it up. Ron DeSantis, when he was dating, he would take women to Thai restaurants, restaurants that serve Thai food, and he would say, are you into Thai food? And wait for them to correct him and then say, this isn't going to work, because they knew how to pronounce the word Thai when he and he knew how to pronounce, but he wanted to see if they would go along with his gaslighting or whatever. Like, what the hell? That tells you so much about who Ron DeSantis is and what he's interested in. He's an insecure child. He's a buffoon, and he shouldn't be in charge of anything, much less my home state. And if you are a Florida person, a Floridian who supports Ron DeSantis, you need to change your ways and think better about who you want leading your state. All right, enough of education. Let's talk quickly about killer robots. Beep, boop, the humans are dead. The humans are dead. I need to get these jingles back, man. Two rival robo-taxi services win approval to operate throughout San Francisco despite safety concerns. This is a fascinating article. I didn't know anything about this until I just found it today. Notice the picture here, and those of you on the audio syncast can't see the picture, but it is I'll read you the caption. SEIU is a union called the Service Employees International Union. Local 87 president Olga Miranda Center speaks in support of a proposed robo-taxi expansion on Thursday, August 10th, 2023 in San Francisco. I was surprised by that because usually unions are opposed to putting robots in charge of the work. And so I was like, what? I was very confused by that. Let me tell you the story and then I'll get back to it, because they don't ever quote her in the actual article. But a lot of articles have this woman, Olga Miranda, as the main photo. So anyway, here's the story from The Hill. California regulators on Thursday approved an expansion that will allow two rival robo-taxi services to operate throughout San Francisco at all hours, despite safety worries spurred by recurring problems with unexpected stops and other erratic behavior that resulted in unmanned vehicles blocking traffic, including emergency vehicles. The state's Public Utilities Commission voted to approve rival services from Cruise and Waymo, those are the two companies, Cruise and Waymo, to operate around-the-clock service. It will make San Francisco the first major U.S. city with two fleets of driverless vehicles competing for passengers against ride hailing and taxi services dependent on humans to operate the cars. Now, anybody who's familiar with this show knows I am opposed to robots doing all the work. Part of it is because there are a lot of problems with how these robots operate. And as the article points out, at one point they blocked an ambulance or something, and it's bad news. If there were a failsafe that, you know, emergency responders could push and the robot car in its way would immediately move to the side of the road, cool. But that doesn't exist. And even beyond the technical hiccups, because at some point those technical hiccups will presumably be ironed out, right? PC gaming was once a horrible mess that nobody wanted to deal with because there were so many technical problems. And now those technical problems have mostly been solved. So we can game on the PC in a much easier way. Are there still problems with gaming on PC? Yeah, but not many. My point is that that's how technology often works. People object to the technical problems, and then the technical problems get solved, and the larger theoretical problems aren't usually addressed because the technical problems have been solved, and therefore the assumption is, well, everything's fine with this technology now. No. Even if these robo-taxi services worked perfectly, they would still be a problem because the humans who do the work now of driving us around, what will happen to them, right? And usually unions are trying to protect the humans who do this kind of work. So it's surprising to me that the SEIU president spoke out in favor of these robo-taxi companies. Let me come back to her in a second, because why do most unions... Okay, and let me say this. I am not opposed to technology making our lives easier at the cost of some human jobs, right? Once upon a time, there were people who made horseshoes for the horses that moved humans around. And when cars showed up, those people who made those horseshoes suddenly were out of work, right? I do not believe we should have banned cars in order to preserve the people who made horseshoes having jobs. Those jobs should have phased out. And obviously there are still a few people who make horseshoes, but not too many. The point is that some technology is good enough to make it needless for people to do shit work, right? Excuse my cursing. If we suddenly had robots picking up all the trash and humans didn't have to pick up the trash anymore, I think that would be okay, as long as we share the wealth that is generated by the robots doing that work. That's really the problem. The problem isn't actually, will people be able to drive cabs or trucks? I mentioned semi trucks moving freight across the U.S., right? At some point soon, robots are going to be driving those trucks. That's going to happen. Everybody says it's an inevitability. That's not a problem in and of itself. The question is, will those people who used to drive trucks find other worthwhile work? Will they have some sort of guaranteed income? Or will they just be thrown out into the cold and said, sucks to be you. That's a you problem. Go learn how to code computer programs or something. Because that's not the way for us to do it as a civilized society. Stephen Hawking, in one of the last things he said before he died, he did an AMA on Reddit. And he was asked about automation. And you know what? I'm going to pull it up. I think I have it bookmarked. Let's see if I have this bookmark ready. Because I want to pull it up. I think it's under quotes and political sources. Wealth and no, that's wealth and equality. Oh man, am I going to be able to find it here? Wait, maybe if I just start typing it into Chrome. Who did I say I was talking about? Stephen Hawking. Yeah, there we go. Comments on site. Here we go. I got the AMA. Thank you, Google Chrome, for knowing what I'm looking for. All right. So he was asked about. So the person asked. Someone asked. Okay, here's the question. Have you thought about the possibility of technological unemployment, where we develop automated processes that ultimately cause large unemployment by performing jobs faster and or cheaper than people can perform them? People compare this to the thought of the Luddites 100 years ago. So much work is automated, whatever, whatever. Here's what Stephen Hawking said. Quote, if machines produce everything we need, the outcome will depend on how things are distributed. Everyone can enjoy a life of luxurious leisure if the machine-produced wealth is shared. Or most people can end up miserably poor if the machine owners successfully lobby against wealth redistribution. So far, the trend seems to be toward the second option, with technology driving ever-increasing inequality. I could not add anything to that. I can't put it better myself. Stephen Hawking sounds like a raging communist there, I know, but that's the smart way to think about it. Some company that owns a robot should not be allowed to just snatch all the wealth that is being generated by humans right now and say, it's all mine because I own these robots. Once upon a time, the public airwaves were considered a public trust. And if you operated ABC, NBC, CBS, you had to do certain things as a part of that public partnership. If you're going to use our airways, I say if robot trucking companies are going to use our highways, which are repaired with our taxes, they have to pay into a fund that distributes some, at least some of that wealth to all of us, especially the people who used to drive trucks for a living. Is that a radical idea? Does that seem so crazy? I don't think that seems crazy. I think that's just a sensible way to go about dealing with this transition to robots driving trucks. Because there are benefits to robot driving trucks, right? Look, human beings driving trucks, first of all, they're on insane schedules. And this isn't really to do with robots right now, but let me just make this clear, okay? I have a friend who drives a tractor truck. I've read books, memoirs from people who drive trucks. They're on insane schedules, right? They're told they need to go from Wisconsin to Florida in, I don't know how, the bare minimum amount of time required. No time for sleeping in hotels, no time for meals, none of it. Just get there. It's speed, speed, speed. That's what allows you to make a living as a truck driver. What does that mean for the human beings who are driving those trucks? They are they're constantly on the brink of exhaustion, stress. They're sleep deprived often, and that's not their fault. That's the company's fault because they're pushing these drivers to the absolute limit of human endurance. Unfortunately, that means that some drivers have to like take caffeine pills or they have to engage in other stimulants, constantly guzzling coffee or whatever it is, in order to stay awake, to stay alert, to stay safe. And if ever there's an accident, it's the driver who is blamed because the companies can say, well, we have all these rules in place for people being safe. But nobody is willing to attack the companies for pushing these drivers to such inhuman lengths. Tracy Morgan did it when his limo was rear-ended by a Walmart driver, and Walmart had to pay a settlement in that case. But that's rare. And it wouldn't have happened if Tracy Morgan was not a famous comedian. Anyway, so these robo-taxi companies, so I went looking for, because I was very curious about this president of Local 87, and the only article I could find that actually talked about her was something from the Indie Bay organization. Indie Media is a thing that exists, and it should exist. Unfortunately, the writing isn't always very good, and this article is very badly written, but it gives us a little bit of information. So there was a battle in San Francisco at the California Public Utilities Commission, CPUC, where the SEIU 87 president opposed the rest of the organized labor folks who were there. So the Olga Miranda supported Cruise, owned by GM, and Waymo, which is owned by Google. However, the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, I think IBT, District Council President Jason Rabinowitz said the Teamsters and California AFL-CIO were united against allowing robot taxis from expanding. So this was a case where one person who's in charge of SEIU 87 was basically going against all the other labor organizations lobbying against these robo-taxis. And Miranda reported the expansion of robo-taxis after Cruise signed a union contract to provide jobs for a few members. She argued that she's only representing her members. So because this company promised some jobs for presumably janitors or whatever, custodial workers, therefore she agreed to support the expansion of robo-taxis. Now, notice what's happening here. Because she's speaking out in favor of these robo-taxis, every news outlet that I looked at this article on is featuring her as a proponent of these robot taxis, making it look like labor in general was supportive of these robot taxis, which is not the case. So yes, this is a case of the media choosing a certain way of framing the issue, but it's also a sad depiction of, or it's a sad statement about what happens when an individual with certain representative power supports a piece of legislation that can lead to a skewed vision of what organized labor as a whole thinks. And that doesn't mean that she has a responsibility to never support anything that the rest of the labor movement opposes, but it does mean that if you're in a position of stature, if you're in a position of public, you know, representation, it means something when she goes out there with an SEIU shirt on, right? It means that she has the potential to make people think something that isn't really justified. And I just think that she might not think that she has that power, but across the United States, a lot of people are seeing SEIU in support of robo-taxis, which is a very strange phenomenon, right? So that's all I have to say about that. When it comes to robots, in addition to the Stephen Hawking quote, two sources that I will recommend to you are a couple of books. The two best books, well, the best book I've ever read about women, about robots. There's two. One is Zeros and Ones, which is by Sadie Plant, which is an excellent book about women and their deep involvement in the history of computers and robots and technology. And then the other book that I really recommend is Manuel DeLanda's book called War in the Age of Intelligent Machines. And what it does is it looks at the development of robots and technology from the point of view of a robot historian, right? In 100 years, when a robot historian looks back on how technology evolved to the point where robot historians came to be, what role did humans play in that evolution? And it's such an interesting, fresh way to think about technology. I read this back at New College, and I need to read it again because it came out in 91 and I read it pretty soon after that, and it just blew me away. It changed the way I think about a lot of things, and I really strongly recommend it. It's a fascinating book. He's a really interesting guy. The other book that I recommend, and I've only started reading it and it's not perfect, it's not as well written as I would have liked, but I'm early, I'm only on chapter 2. It's called The Smart Wife: Why Siri, Alexa, and Other Smart Home Devices Need a Feminist Reboot. It's a very interesting look at the origins of modern, what they call smart wives, you know, Alexa, Siri, Google Home, the robots that are appearing in our homes that take care of certain tasks that have often been the domain of women. And it's a really interesting look at the history of robotics marketing, popular culture representations of robots, how these devices and software and hardware things are programmed, how they are designed, because all of those things bring with them our social assumptions, and they reflect a lot about how the world is and how it ought to be. There's another book called Feminism Confronts Technology. I'm trying to pull it up here. There we go. Judy Walkman. There we go. Feminism. Thank you, Goodreads, for knowing what I was looking for. Judy Walkman wrote a book called Feminism Confronts Technology, and the authors of The Smart Wife keep referring back to this. It's a really interesting book. And yeah, so, it's about these questions of what technology reflects about the world that existed before this technology existed, what the technology perpetuates or continues in those assumptions, and what it allows us to change in terms of our thinking or whatever. A lot of people think of Alexa and Siri as being ungendered, but they're not, right? You get to choose whether it's a male or female voice on Siri. And Siri, I don't really have much relationship with Alexa. We don't have any Alexa devices. My brother has one in Florida, and it was interesting to interact with it. But I do use Siri on my phone here. And mainly it's when I need directions to a place and Siri will tell me, turn right up here in 100 yards, turn left. I set it to a male Australian voice. I just think it's interesting. But most people use the female voice. And the question becomes why? And what are the implications of that? And I don't want to go too far into it, but I just think it's very interesting to think about the meanings and the significance of those decisions about how consumers use it and how things are designed. So anyway, it's a really good book so far. It's not perfect. Like I say, the writing's not great, but it's very interesting, and I'm curious to see where the rest of the book will go. All right, let's talk about hip hop. It's bigger than hip hop, hip hop, hip hop. All right, go away ads. Today, as I said at the start of the show, today is the day, 50 years ago, where a guy named Kool Herc, DJ Kool Herc, threw a block party at 1520 Sedgwick Avenue. And it is often considered to be the birth of hip hop. It was a fundraiser for back to school supplies for kids. It was a turning point in popular culture and music, and it started this revolution known as hip hop. For all the reasons I'm not going to get into right now, DJ Kool Herc was considered the first hip hop DJ. He started mixing and doing remixes of songs. He laid down beats in a way that allowed MCs to come along and rap over those beats. And that gave rise. So it was DJing first. The four elements of hip hop are DJing. MCing came second. It's important that we know that the DJ came first. The MC came second and started rapping over the beats. But at the same time, there were graffiti artists. That's the third element of hip hop. And there were B-boys and B-girls doing dancing. Some of it was breakdancing, but a lot of the B-boys and B-girls refer to it as, it's B-boying and B-girl. It's dancing, basically, and whatever. Hip-hop dance has become a genre of dance that's usually done by folks in suburban studios. That's pretty different from the way that hip-hop dancing traditionally has been done, and the kind of dancing that happens in a lot of actual hip-hop clubs, where a lot of African-American folks do different kinds of dancing. So it's interesting to see the way that the terms breakdancing and hip-hop dance are often used in different ways. Not in correct ways necessarily, but just there's different kinds of dance that are all using the term hip-hop. Because hip-hop, if nothing else, has become a thing that has many, many different meanings, many different manifestations. And nothing shows that more clearly than Call of Duty celebrating 50 years of hip-hop. How is Call of Duty celebrating 50 years of hip-hop? Some sort of tribute to Kool Herc? Some sort of celebration of the four elements? No! They're offering you guns, and they're offering you the option to play as Snoop Dogg or Nicki Minaj. Now, no disrespect to Snoop or Nicki or Savage 21. I don't even know who that is. I showed you how disconnected I am from the modern hip-hop in 2023. Sorry, I like artists like Che Noir and... I'm blanking on the other artists who are really big right now. Obviously, I love Kendrick Lamar. I have a lot of respect for artists like, Wale, and I don't even know the names of a lot of... I mean, look, Black Thought's still making music in 2023. Paris is still making music in 2023. There are a lot of artists I love from back in the day who are still making music today. By the way, Trugoy from De La Soul passed away right before their music came onto Spotify. That broke my heart. So I will admit that I am an old white dude who is disconnected from the popular hip-hop of today. But nevertheless, as Scroobius Pip, another middle-aged white dude, said, guns, bitches, and bling were never part of the four elements and never will be. So for Call of Duty to be celebrating 50 years of hip-hop with this purchasable package where you can play a Snoop Dogg, you can have a special hip-hop gun, it's kind of a disgrace. It's kind of disgusting, to be honest. And I love to see people celebrating creative people like Snoop Dogg, and he is a very creative person. Nevertheless, I feel like this is celebrating one tiny aspect of hip-hop, and the whole rest of the hip-hop culture is being ignored by Call of Duty. Not that I really expected more from Activision or Blizzard, but nevertheless, it's still very sad to see hip-hop presented in terms of just guns, right? Because guns have always been part of ghetto culture in the United States since at least the 80s. And that's because of white supremacy and the oppression of poor people, forcing a lot of black poor people to live in places where you live by the gun and you die by the gun. And for Call of Duty to say, yeah, hip hop, it ignores the fact that the Stop the Violence movement put out a song called Self-Destruction, which is all about ending gun violence, right? And so that's why I get mad at Call of Duty for trying to celebrate hip hop, quote unquote, celebrate with this gun pack. All right, moving on. Let's do a quote and wrap this up because I've been talking a lot and it's time to move on to something else. I still do have the jingle for the quote of the show. So let's play that. Friends, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. Stop repenting because the end is near. But don't panic, you can't function if you live in a fear. Pay attention, you gotta listen to hear. Wait, gentlemen. And that's Talib Kweli, who is another very awesome hip-hop artist who I love very much. Although he was accused of some sexual misconduct at one point. He never responded to it. I think that's messed up. I think he should talk about it. I think he, whatever. Yeah, that bothers me. All right, here's the quote of the week. William Butler Yeats was an Irish poet and one of the foremost figures of 20th century literature. His poem, The Second Coming, provided the epigraph for Chinua Achebe's novel, Things Fall Apart. And there's a line in it that I thought was very important. So let me read you part of this poem. This might be the whole thing. I don't know. Turning and turning in the widening gyre, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart. The center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The blood-dimmed tide is loosed, and everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. Surely some revelation is at hand. Surely the second coming is at hand. The second coming! Hardly are those words out when a vast image out of Spiritus Mundi troubles my sight. Somewhere in sands of the desert, a shape with lion body and the head of a man, a gaze blank and pitiless as the sun, is moving its slow thighs, while all about it reel shadows of the indignant desert birds. The darkness drops again, but now I know that 20 centuries of stony sleep were vexed to nightmare by a rocking cradle, and what rough beast, its hour come round at last, slouches toward Bethlehem to be born. I love that line. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. Let us, the best, or the people who believe themselves to be the best, get some conviction. Let us gain that passion and intensity and not allow only the worst of our species and our civilization to claim that passion and intensity. It is not wrong for us to be passionate. It is good for us to be passionate. Let us not be ignorant or hasty in our passion, but let us reclaim passion for goodness and fight against the evils of the world with passion and conviction, because there's hope. There's always hope, people. Hope dies last. All right, that's it, people. Show notes and links to everything in this podcast are on my blog, Didactic Syncast, Synapse, fbesp.org/synapse. But sometimes I don't post there very often, so they'll be in the show notes here for this podcast. My website is The Floating Brain of Eric S. Piotrowski, which is fbesp.org, with links to music and fiction that I've written, books like Nimbus X and multimedia and lots of other stuff. Shout-outs this week to you for joining us, JLV for joining us in the chat. Thank you so much for being here as I record live. And the Duchess, who is great. Everybody who has shown love for Nimbus X, and too many people to name here, but I don't have a lot of time to edit this thing, so I apologize if there's dumb stuff I forgot to cut out. I'm a very busy man. Deal with it. I can play this.
Listen, I don't have time to play with the phone here. I got a lot of stuff I got to get done.
Thank you for listening, people. Please get in touch with feedback or questions. You can find me on Threads at Duke Scath. I have basically left X. I still have an account, but I don't like using that program. So find me on Threads at Duke Scath. And I think that's it. I'm going to stop talking now.
Didactic Syncast is a production of The Floating Brain of Eric S. Piotrowski, which is solely responsible for its content. This program is a joint venture of Ribonucleic Records and Garrison Multimedia. Our show is made possible by a grant from the Fargus Foundation. Some restrictions may apply. See SOAR for details. Fight the power.
So powerful.
I think that went relatively well for a first time streaming to YouTube.